Hello, everyone. This is Frank, executive producer of non-productive.com. You're going to notice some audio quality issues with this episode of SNL Nerds. Since this is a pretty special episode, we decided to correct it as best as we could and air it. So we hope you enjoy and apologies in advance.
Hey, from New Jersey, it's the SNL Nerds, the show where two comics from New Jersey nerd out about Saturday Night Live. I'm your co-host, Darren Patterson.
And I'm your co-host, John Trumbull.
John, how you feeling today, man? How you holding up there?
Yeah, we got to get into a little backstory this week. I should explain... we're not doing the movie that we originally announced we were going to do for this episode. Originally, we were going to do was it a 1980 film?
Yeah.
How to Beat the High Cost of Living with Gene Curtin and Susan St. James, which I think is streaming on Amazon. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. And that was the plan that we were all set. And then life, as it does, throws a huge monkey wrench at you. On this past Monday, the day that our last episode was released, my best friend of 25 years, or 26 years, Frankie Vitarello, passed away very suddenly Monday morning. And so, you know, most of my week has been kind of consumed with that. We had a memorial for him just the other day. And yeah, I mean, he'd had a lot of health problems in the last few years. So it was, his health had been in quite a fragile state for most of the last decade. So this wasn't entirely unexpected, but it's still, you know, just kind of blew us away. You know, he was only 43 years old, just a month shy of turning 44. And, it was a shock. It was a shock. And we decided to do as kind of a tribute to Frank, do one of his favorite movies. And this is a movie that he turned me on to. And this is a movie that has a very special meaning to him and me, A Wet Hot American Summer from 2001. And this was a movie that Frank showed me. And this was a movie that kind of symbolizes our fandom of comedy in the early 2000s. Frank, I've mentioned him in passing on the show a few times before. Like he was the guy that every Wednesday we would go into the city together to watch Invite Them Up, which was a comedy show in the East Village. And we got to know several of the people from this movie. I mentioned a few weeks back, I went to a 4th of July party, and that was like a rooftop thing in the city. And David Wayne and Joe Latrulio were there, and some other people from the state. Frank got to know them quite a bit. He was a very passionate fan of comedy. And quite honestly, if I hadn't been friends with Frank, it's very possible I might never have tried stand-up comedy myself. So, I mean, he had a pretty profound influence on my life, and he turned me on to a lot of cool things.
Wow.
And I'm really going to miss that guy.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I never got a chance to meet him, but like I saw on Monday, like you said, like you texted me saying if I could write up the little podcast write-up that you normally do. For our last episode, the Wine Country episode, and then you told me about the situation, and I was like, "Oh my God, I'm sorry to hear that. My condolences." Yeah. And I was pretty shocked as well.
Yeah, well, you did meet Frank in passing at least a time or two. He did come with us to. I know he was part of us, like the Marvel movie group. He did join us for Black Panther, I believe it was.
Wow. And
maybe one or two others.
That seems like a lifetime ago, but, I like you said, I probably met him briefly, but I really wish I got to talk to him more and got to know him more, because it sounds like he's a huge comedy nerd, like you said. Although I think you did mention, you say he never was quite the SNL nerd, but like he was a big fan of comedy nonetheless.
Yeah, that was a kind of irony thing. Like I totally wanted to have Frankie on the show someday, and I had a whole plan for, like, you know, when the new Ghostbusters movie came out or was scheduled to come out sometime this summer. My plan was we would do a whole thing on, you know, we'd cover the two original Ghostbusters movies. We'd cover the remake. And I also wanted to cover the Ghostbusters video game that came out, I don't know how many years ago, at least 10 years ago. Because Frankie was a big video game guy. And that Ghostbusters video game was essentially like a Ghostbusters 3 with the original cast, because they got the original cast back to voice that. And I thought Frank would be an ideal guest for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
He was one of the regulars on a video game podcast called the Digital Press Podcast. And he was a huge video game guy. That was like one of his big passions. And so, you know, I hate that we never got the chance to do that episode. But yeah, Frank, he was a big comedy fan, but he was not particularly a fan of Saturday Night Live. He became a fan of a lot of SNL cast members, like after they left the show and started making movies or whatever.
Okay.
You know, like he loved Will Ferrell and Anchorman. And,
of course.
Yeah. But I think he just didn't really want to wade through the mixed bag that is the show every single week. He was a big fan of sketch comedy. He loved Monty Python. He loved The State. And, you know, so he was a big fan of those guys. So this movie was right up his alley.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, it sounds like he's the one that, like, hipped you to this movie, because, like you said, we're doing What Happened American Summer, directed by David Wayne, written by David Wayne and Michael Showalter, both from The State. This movie came out on July 27th, 2001. Had a budget of like 1.8 mil, and it grossed about like $295,000. So this wasn't a big hit movie by any stretch of the imagination. Because like I remember when this came out, this movie was like really. It was like almost like a secret. Like, I don't remember seeing any promotions for it. I don't remember seeing any commercials for it, really. And, like, you know, I was in New York at the time, and it seems like, I think it was only playing in, like, one theater or, like, two theaters. It was, like, this movie was, like, under the radar. So, I mean, was it Frankie that kind of told you about this, or did you already know about it, or how did you guys come to see it?
I missed it in its theatrical run, like I think most people who are fans of this movie. And he just showed it to me on DVD one night, and it was one of those movies that I knew next to nothing about. I mean, I probably like looked at the case and saw who was in it, and I was like, oh yeah, let's check this out. This sounds cool. And it really, really blew me away, because if you've seen this movie, it's a movie that gets increasingly more bizarre and surreal as it goes on. It's a really tough movie to summarize. I don't know how good of a job we're going to do summarizing it, because it's really much more about the gags than the plot.
Yeah, because actually that's what I was kind of worried about when we were going to talk about this movie, because there isn't like a kind of natural, I guess there is a bit of a storyline through it, but
there is,
yeah, there is, but yeah. Like it's going to be, like you said, it's going to be hard to describe, because I mean, when I first heard about this and I watched it like years ago, I thought it would kind of be like a straightforward parody of 80s summer camp movies, like, you know, like in the vein of, you know, Naked Gun and Airplane. And it is kind of like that, but then there's like it is, but it's not quite like that, because it's also, like you said, really weird and surreal and absurdist in a lot of places. Like, it's one of those movies where I really couldn't predict what was going to happen next. Like, each moment was like, oh, this is, it just kept throwing me off.
Yeah, and this movie, it really was a wonderful surprise in the best way. And actually, like, I mean, there is a real cult that's arisen around this movie. And another reason I picked this movie is because, like, a few years after it was released and unfortunately flopped, it became like a midnight movie in New York City for a couple of years there. And Frankie was part of the regular group of people who would like introduce the movie, and he would dress up usually as Gene, the cook character played by Christopher Maloney, you know, with a beard, and he had a handkerchief around his head and a sleeveless shirt. And he had like a little can of vegetables, the same Del Monte brand, I believe it was. And I went to a few of those. I didn't go to every single one, like I believe Frank did, but I did go up one. I think the first one was right around Halloween, and a lot of the cast was there. I remember Paul Rudd was dressed up as Freddie Mercury.
Oh,
he was in like,
nice.
He had a fake mustache and he had fake teeth to make him look more like Freddie Mercury. And he was in the, like a tight jumpsuit where the top was sort of like a an undershirt. I don't know if there's a special term for that type of jumpsuit thing, but you know, one of those tight things that Freddie Mercury
like wore. A leotard or something.
Yes, a leotard. That would probably be the term I was looking for.
There you go.
A leotard. and yeah, so I remember that. And I remember David Wayne, he was dressed up like Bill Murray in Lost in Translation. He was in a tuxedo, but it was clipped in the back, like when he was Bill Murray's character in Lost in Translation was shooting the Suntory commercial.
Oh, for relaxing time, make it Suntory time.
Yeah, and it was they put little clips on the back of his tux to give him like this nice silhouette.
Wow! All right, did you dress up as anything or no?
I put together. I remember I got notice on like kind of short notice on this, so I threw together a Henry costume for David Hyde Pierce's character.
Oh, nice!
Because that was one I could do relatively easily. So just really shorts, a button down plaid shirt, a fake mustache, and glasses. And I did get to say, oh, fuck my cock in front of an audience of at least 200 people.
Okay.
So that was fun.
Yeah, guys, well, if you've never seen What Hot American Summer, we'll explain all of this in this episode. Like, you know, fuck my cock and all that jazz.
Yeah, yeah. No, at one point, David Hyde Pierce just, he looks at something and he goes, oh, fuck my cock. And he just says it in that offhanded sort of tone of voice. And it is hilarious.
Yeah, this movie is, oof. I mean, I guess the first time the first time I saw this movie, there were a couple scenes where I'm like, what? Like, it really kind of was like jarring to me a little bit. We'll get into it, but this movie really kind of rattled me a bit. But like,
did you have to seek counseling because of this movie?
I had to lie down, you know, a nice glass of water, and just kind of really. Uh-huh. Reflect, but like after seeing it the second time, like kind of knowing what to expect, I appreciate it a lot more the second time than it. The first time I was just really like bewildered by baffled by what I was seeing, but the second time I was like, all right, now I get it. I can get to the rhythm of it now.
Oh, okay. So it was like a grower, not a shower for you.
Oh, I don't know if I'd put it that way, but yes.
Why wouldn't you put it that way? What's wrong?
You know, not nothing. It's fine. But yeah, it was a grower, not a shower, as they say.
Right. Okay. Okay. Good.
All right. Let's get into it. So, One Hot American Summer, it's a movie that takes place on the last day of camp on August 18th, 1981.
Yes, at Firewood.
Yes.
Which is a day camp. They never really say that it's a Jewish summer camp, but it's basically a Jewish summer camp.
Yeah, because I think this was, from what I've read, this was based on David Wayne's time at camp when he was a kid. He went to a Jewish camp, and like Michael Showalter also went to camp during the summer. So this movie's kind of based on those two things. Firewood takes place in Maine, although they actually shot it in a camp in Pennsylvania, Camp Towanda.
Yes. Yes, they did, and they were they shot it in the year 2000, and they had some bad luck during the shooting of this. It rained 23 out of the 28 days they were shooting this movie.
Oof.
Which, when you have most of your movie taking place outdoors over a single summer day, that's not a good thing.
You can't just CGI that out.
No.
Oh.
No. I mean, and in fact, you can, if you look carefully during the movie, you can see on the ground how muddy it is from all the rain. And some of the indoor scenes in the cabins, you can, like, look out the window and you can see, like, the rain dribbling down.
Oh, boy.
But, yeah.
Yeah, it's, yeah, it's, yeah. Yeah, it's not good.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, so the movie opens with a bunch of counselors by a bonfire, you know, getting drunk, smoking the devil's lettuce. And you hear Jane playing from Jefferson Starship. It's a pretty dope-ass song. Like, this is another thing about this movie. This movie introduced me to that song, Jane, which I quite thoroughly enjoy to this day.
Yeah, it introduced me to another couple songs. It's a nice soundtrack, well-chosen, a lot of early 80s things. The campers early on, they sing Jukebox Hero by Foreigner. And they've got the opening song from Rick Springfield's Working Class Dog. Is that the name of the album?
Working Class Dog? I think so.
So
Rick Springfield knowledge is a little limited.
It plays a song. It's the song Love Is All Right Tonight. And yes, it is the first song, single from his album Working Class Dog.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. So then we get to know our main characters. The counselors, we got Coop, played by Michael Showalter, who has a huge crush on Katie, who
played by Marguerite Moreau.
Right.
But Katie is dating this other camp counselor named Andy, who's played by Paul Rudd, who's just a quintessential douche.
Yeah.
Quintessential douchey boyfriend. You know, at one point, you see him and Katie making out early on, and he's just like, God, Katie, why are you smothering me? And then within seconds, he's like, I love you, baby. Okay, bye.
Yeah, like, Paul Rudd kind of, he pretty much steals the show here. Like, he just plays, like, this douchey, like, nonchalant, just combative type of dude. But it's like, it's hilarious, though, the way he does it, just because he just seems, like, so clueless and just ready to just, like, you know, be dismissive and fight anybody at the drop of a hat and then be like, oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, Paul Rudd, it's just a pretty fearless performance. And he's, you know, you still like him because, well, you know, A, it's Paul Rudd. And B, he just goes for it, man. And apparently this was a big calling card for him in the comedy world. It helped him get the job in Anchorman a few years later because Judd Apatow was a fan of Wet Hot.
Far out.
So we got some other characters. We've got Janine Garofalo as Beth. She's the camp director, and she has a crush on a scientist, Professor Henry Newman, played by David Hyde Pierce, who has a house like across from the camp, and he's an associate professor. He's an astrophysicist, and she invites him over to teach the kids astrophysics on the last day of camp.
Oh, right, because she wants. I think, like, he walks into the mess hall where everybody's at, and then he asks him, hey, do you know where the indoor kids are at? And he's like, oh, that's bunk three. And, of course, it's all stereotypical, nerdy, dorky kids.
There's one kid in the Mork suspenders. There's one kid who's a big D&D freak. He wears a cape.
Yes. Keith Steck from Milburn, New Jersey.
Yes. Yeah, we get a nice New Jersey shout out, State Bird the Mosquito.
Yes. Yes, he's a Crown Class B Dungeon Master.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know that's impressive.
Ladies!
Let's see, who else do we have? We have Ken Marino as Victor Pulak, another counselor. He's got a beautiful Jufro.
It's puffy, and it's magnificent.
Yeah, and he seems like his character, you're like, oh, he's the horn dog. He's the big horny dude. He's the playa. Because he's just talking about, you know, effing the ladies.
Yeah. Slipping the Frank in the bun.
Yeah. The ultimate penis and vagina. we have Christopher Maloney as Gene, who is the camp cook, and he is a Vietnam veteran, and he's kind of freaky.
Yeah, he kind of, but it's weird. Did he do this before Law & Order SVU, or was this during?
He shot this apparently like right after he shot the first season of SVU. So SVU started in 1999, and this was shot in the summer of 2000 and released in 2001.
Yeah, okay.
We have Amy Poehler and Bradley Cooper in the first film for both. Amy Poehler and Bradley Cooper are Susie and Ben, who are the theater camp counselors. And Bradley Cooper actually missed his graduation from the Actors Studio in New York so he could do this film, because he was shooting this film. He completed his studies, of course, right. But I believe he just his graduation ceremony.
No, that's fair enough. That's an even trade. Oh, and also, I don't know if you mentioned, this is also David Wayne's first movie ever.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it's his directorial debut, and David Wayne has gone on to direct several other movies. He's directed The Ten, Wanderlust, Role Models. I'm probably forgetting something.
There's another movie he did, which I thought was really good. It was kind of a sleeper hit. It's called They Came Together, which was like a parody of rom-coms.
You know, I wasn't too nuts about that when I watched that, but I should give that another try sometime. That had Amy Poehler and Paul Rudd. And David Wayne, he also directed a movie we've covered on this podcast before, a Futile and Stupid Gesture.
Yeah, absolutely. Another great film he did. And also, so They Came Together, he did Wanderlust, Role Models, The Ten. All movies that have Paul Rudd in them.
Well, I mean, if you're doing a movie and you have the option to have Paul Rudd in your movie, have Paul Rudd in your movie if you're crying out loud.
That's great. Like, I feel like Paul Rudd is like the Johnny Depp to David Wayne's Tim Burton.
I can see that. Sure. Yeah. I will sign on. I will co-sign that analogy. Let's see. We also have Michael Ian Black as McKinley. We have another SNL alum, Molly Shannon, as Gail, who is the art teacher, who strangely cannot say the word crayons. She says crayons, which just jumps out at me and is nails on a chalkboard to me every time I watch this movie. But
is that how she really says it in real life, crayons?
I'm assuming that is how Molly Shannon says the word crayons. She says crayons.
I didn't know if there was a character choice or not, but I didn't even notice that. I got to go back and look at that now.
I don't know. But now you will notice it forever longer.
Yes. Thanks, Sean.
Yep. And let's see. We got, who else have I not mentioned?
There's Nurse Nancy. There's Gary, played by 80 Miles.
80 Miles, who went on to become the head writer of, I believe, Jimmy Fallon's Late Night. If I remember correctly.
Right. That sounds about right.
Yeah, he was the head writer for Tonight Show starring Jimmy Fallon from 2014 to 2017, and he helped develop that show. We have Zach Worth as JJ, who's done a lot of stuff. He's also been in The Baxter, Melinda and Melinda, In-N-Out, Music and Lyrics, and NYC 22. We have Marissa Ryan as Abby Bernstein. Kevin Sussman as Steve, who's one of the campers, and he was he's best known these days for being on The Big Bang Theory. He played Stewart, the comic shop owner.
That's where I knew him from. I was like, I was like, who is that guy? Because he kind of looks like, I feel like he looks like the guy from The Strokes, but I was like, but that's not the guy from The Strokes.
Yeah, I can see the resemblance though. We have Elizabeth Banks as Lindsay. This was also her film debut.
Yes, Banks.
Yeah. We have Joe Latrullio, who's best known nowadays for Brooklyn Nine-Nine as Charles Boyle. I believe it was his first film. H. John Benjamin pops up in a voice role, and Judah Friedlander has a cameo at the end.
Yeah, so this is like a big, beefy cast. I mean, a lot of... Mm-hmm. The cast members, like their first film or like early on in their career, this film, and like they all went on to huge things. So this is,
it's a deep bench of talent, man. There's a lot of good people, and it's a lot of interweaving storylines in this movie.
Right. I mean, we have the one storyline where Beth, you know, Janine Garofalo's character, wants Victor to take the kids to Moose River for the mm-hmm. night before, you know, the parents come picking them up the next day. But, like, you know, Victor doesn't want to do it with Ed because, you know, he's trying to score with Abby. And there's that storyline, and there's the other storyline where Coop has a crush on Katie, and but you know, Katie's boyfriend Andy is kind of doing her dirty and making out with Lindsay, and
and while he's doing that, we have a subplot with Andy through his negligence just letting various campers die on his watch, and then he will murder other campers to cover up the first deaths.
Right.
So I believe the final tally is like four campers are dead because of Andy's actions over the course of the movie.
Yeah.
But because it's Paul Rudd, you still love
him. Yeah, that. But I don't think they... I mean, they don't show him actually murdering children, but like they do show, like, you know, he's negligent. He's like too busy making out, and there's a kid drowning in front of him. He doesn't save the kid. And then, you know, one of the other kids says, hey, you know, I'm going to tell Beth or whoever that you let that kid drown. And then they cut to a shot of like Andy taking the kid out to like, well, he said he's taking the kid out to like a pizza party. And then as they drive away, like he just throws a kid out of the side of the road.
Yeah, I mean, he pushes the kid out of a moving van. I think it's safe to say that we do see him murdering a child.
Yeah, I guess.
Apparently in an earlier draft, though, it was even more explicit of, they had a draft where he like takes the kid out to the woods and like takes out a gun and puts on a silencer and puts like two in the kid's head. So, but that apparently went a little too far. Even David Wayne's father was like, if you shoot this, I will disown you.
I get it. I get it. Yeah, murdering a child. Maybe you don't see the humor in it.
Yeah, no, but it's much funnier to see a child's body just being thrown out of a moving van, and then he bounces off the landscape.
And that's comedy.
And then we also had the tentative romance between Beth and Henry, the astrophysicist. There's so many plots. There, Susie and Ben, Amy Poehler and Amy Bradley Cooper's character, they're putting together a talent show for the last day of camp. Beth asks Kevin Sussman's character of the weird kid. He's like, well, hey, why don't you be in the talent show? You know, why don't you show the thing you've been working on all summer?
We'll get to that scene, but that scene, that's for the first time when I saw that, I was like, what is happening? Like, that's probably one of the scenes I really was like, I don't understand what this, like, it just... Yeah. I can't even find the words right now to explain it.
The movie's getting really, really weird by that.
Yeah.
Point. And it just gets increasingly weirder as the movie goes on.
well, there's another also storyline with Gail, Molly Shannon's character, who's the arts and crafts teacher, who is going through a divorce right now, and she kind of has a meltdown in front of the kids. And, like, the kids kind of end up trying to help her get through this divorce, and especially one kid, I think Aaron, is like getting like closer and closer to her, just like sort of be her support and her rock. And
he consoles her throughout the movie. And the joke here is that it's like, it's basically like an adult relationship, but it's with like this 12-year-old boy.
I was a little afraid of that. Like, I didn't know how far they would go with that, where it's like, oh, are they going to, are they going to show like this woman making out with a 12-year-old, or like, a part of me was like a little like, I hope they don't go that far with it.
This movie, it does have a surprising amount of adults making out with children over the course of the movie, and it's we have, you know, most of the actors were in their like early 30s, late 20s, early 30s when they were making this movie, but they're all playing 18. Because that they're just kind of making fun of that convention of having people who are far too old for the parts playing teenagers. And they kind of continued that gag later on, because they later got together to make both a prequel and a sequel to this movie. And they waited, like, it was nearly like 15 years later, and they were playing, they got together for First Day of Camp. And so they were playing the same parts, but 3 months younger, when they're in actuality like 15 years older, and so they're all well into their 40s by that point.
Yeah, like, I mean, I watched a little bit of that today before we started recording. I was like, oh, Michael Showalter, he's an older man. You can definitely tell.
Well, let's not go into who aged the best or the worst. I mean, obviously Paul Rudd aged.
Yeah, man's wins that contest. Yeah, the man's immortal because
he is a Highlander. but yeah, we had Victor Pulak, Ken Marino's character. He confesses to Neil, Joe Latrulio's character, that he is, instead of being the big ladies' man that he presents himself as, he is actually a virgin. And I love that we don't even have a beat of Neil saying like, oh, hey, that's okay, that's all right. No, he just instantly goes, you're a loser. You are a loser.
Yeah, like he just berates him.
And so Victor, after they get to where the kids are going to go white water rafting, he instantly turns back. He's like, I've got to get back to the camp. I got to be with Abby. This is my one shot. And he leaves Neil alone with all the campers, and Neil doesn't have the map. He doesn't know how to whitewater raft. And so Neil, he eventually abandons the campers to go after Victor.
Yeah. And yeah. So it's both campers like leaving the kids just to fend for themselves. And like, I think there's two parts I like to this where Victor's driving the van back and he's singing Danny's song. And then he's just driving along all happy. And he's like, oh, no. And then he just crashes the van right into a tree. And like,
yeah. And it is one of the funniest cuts I have ever seen in a movie. Because he's just literally singing, like, and in the morning when I bring it. And then out of nowhere, he just goes, oh, shit. Jerks the wheel. And then you just see, apropos of nothing, the van crash into a tree.
Yeah, like, we don't even know what he was swerving to miss. I don't think there was anything on the road.
There is no cause for it whatsoever, which just makes it all the funnier. And that, actually, that subplot apparently was based on an incident from David Wayne's real life. When he was a camp counselor, he said he had just turned 16. I was assigned to drive a group of campers to an overnight camping trip and leave the next morning with another counselor and head back to camp. But I had just met this girl at the camp, and I was so excited to see her that I decided, no, I'm going to leave late at night and race back to camp, even though I barely knew how to drive. So I cranked up the tunes, pedaled to the metal, and I was driving through pitch black, winding unpaved roads as fast as I could in hopes of making out with this girl. And about 2 miles away from the campsite, but still in the middle of the state park, I smashed hard into a tree. I lodged the fender deep into the tire, rendering the van utterly undrivable, and was stuck in the middle of the woods. I had no idea how to get back. I couldn't see my hand in front of me, but luckily I did end up wandering back to find the campsite with the kids and the counselor, and they were like, what the hell is wrong with you? After that, they initiated a policy that junior counselors weren't allowed to drive vehicles at camp. I eventually did get to make out with the girl. So
worth it.
David Wayne.
Totally worth it.
Yeah.
If a van has to die for me to get some action, then so be it.
Yeah, no, it was all worth it in the long run.
Hey, high five, bro.
High five. So that's, you know, that's a fun subplot. We see Neil like actually steal a motorcycle to go after Victor, and he's like coming after him to the tune of "Turn Me Loose" by Loverboy.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, very, very funny. There's another subplot. We have two of the characters, J.J. and Gary, A.D. Miles, and J.J. North. Reverse that, though. They're playing the other's characters. And they discover that Michael Ian Black's character, McKinley, seems to be very uncomfortable with sexuality.
Yeah, because
they're ogling some girls who are going, well, they're not really going skinny dipping, but they're going swimming. So they're all in bikinis. They're all stripping down, and they're right. All like, oh, wow, this is so
it's
hot.
Like, it's like the 80s obligatory, oh, let's look at some girls while they're, you know, about to take off their clothes scene.
Right, right, while they're in a state of undress. And and McKinley's like, hey, I'll see you guys later. And then they're all like, oh, well, we should fix McKinley up. We got to get McKinley laid. And while they're hatching this plan, we cut to McKinley sneaking into a wooden shack, and he meets up with Bradley Cooper's Ben, and they start making out and going at it.
Yeah, that's one of the scenes that like that came out of nowhere for me. Whereas, like,
and it goes there. It is pretty explicit for a 2001 movie. Yeah, we see them kiss. We see them take each other's shirts off, and then we cut to them.
Say it.
One of them is behind the other one, and there is some thrusting motion going on.
It is Brokeback Mountain.
It is, yeah, I wish I could quit you. It is, yeah, it is, yeah, there's some full-on gay sex happening.
It's
there.
Just man on man. It's not even played for laughs. That's the thing about it, too, where it's just, like, you expect there to be some type of gag in there or something, but no, it is, you know, just full-on, almost softcore Skinamax, just Michael Ian Black's thrusting into Cooper, just as tender and sweaty.
And I like that, you know, they just cut away to, like, both of their feet, and they're both wearing, like, those striped socks that, you know, all kids wore in the 80s.
Oh, the tube socks, yeah.
Tube socks, yeah. And they're just going at it. They're just thrusting away.
Yeah, I was like, I was not prepared for this.
And a short time later, we see JJ and Gary, they're following McKinley in the woods, and they're like, oh, he's going to make out with Susie. He's going to make out with a chick. And they discover that, no, it's actually McKinley and Ben getting married. And they're like, oh, my God, McKinley's gay. Oh. So we think, you know, just having been conditioned from all these movies in the 80s, we're conditioned to think that these two semi-jerky characters are going to do this horribly homophobic thing. And the rest of the movie, but they have a great unexpected payoff later. I don't know. Should we just talk about each subplot individually? It might make more sense.
Yeah, let's do that. So like you said, like JJ and Gary, like later on in the movie, now that McKinley and Ben are out and proud as a couple, we see JJ and Gary saying, "Hey, you guys, we got something to give you." And we find out they give them a nice chaise lounge.
They're just like, oh, it's a Shea lounge. We had so much trouble finding it. And they're just giving them this heartwarming wedding gift. And the two of them are like, oh, guys. But the lead up to that, it's just, oh, they're going to do some big homophobic stunt. And it's all the funnier because it's not that. I love that the movie just swerved in the different direction.
Right. Swerve, Van. But yeah, because I think at one point even JJ said, like, oh, he's a, you know, F-A-G, but he says the word. So think, oh, it's going to go one way, but then it goes this other. Yeah. Again, like, this movie, I can never, like, the first time I saw it, I never could predict where it's going to go. Like, each scene was like, oh, I didn't see that coming.
Yeah.
Like,
it's, they do a clever job of subverting your expectations.
Yeah,
because they're playing on so many of the cliches of, like, the 80s films and the camp film genre.
Yeah, well, like another thing that happened, I mean, we talk about now the trip into town, which
the trip into town, that is an amazing scene. They go into town, and we get Beth is going into the town. She's going to the library because she likes Henry the astrophysicist. So she decides to read up on his interest in astrophysics, and Henry at the same time is going into town to read up on camp directing because he wants to relate to Beth. And they see that Beth is driving the truck into town, and everybody jumps onto the back of the pickup, and they're like, "Hey, Beth's going into town. And we get this musical montage of just this, of steadily escalating, small petty crimes. Like, you know, we see them smoking, and then they like go into a store and they buy beer. And then we see them smoking pot in the park. And then they're going into an alleyway to buy cocaine, and then they're robbing an old lady. And then finally we just see them in this ratty apartment, and they've all become heroin addicts. And it's like a scene out of Train Spotting or something.
Yeah, that was disturbing. I was like, oh, like, cause they play it so straight. And you just see them, you see like Coop, like tying off and JJ with a needle. Mm-hmm. And you see some of them like freebasing. It looked like Katie just OD'd, and I was like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah. And Amy Poehler, she's all like strung out, and then it just like finally cuts to Janine Ruffalo just twitching. She's just having the shakes. And it's all set to the Rick Springfield song.
Yeah.
This peppy, poppy Rick Springfield song. And it's just all the more hilarious. And then the great payoff, you see them pulling back into camp. Everyone's completely normal. And Gary's like, hey, guys, have a good time in town. And Zach Orth just goes, oh, yeah, it's great to get into town, even if it's just for an hour.
It all happened in an hour?
They all went on that downward spiral in the space of an hour. It's just so absurd, but yet it's so funny.
Yeah, but that's another one of the scenes where it's just like, I was like, whoa, they went there. But I mean, that.
And you know, they also have a neat, another like weird, surreal, like totally unexplained gag is like when you see them coming back, you see two of them like just run off, and everybody runs with the same absurd run. Michael Ian Black and Zach Orth, they run and then they're just standing facing a wall.
Oh yeah, that's it. Yeah, what was that?
And then at the end of Michael Showalter's scene, he just goes, hey guys, wait up. And then he just goes there and he stands facing a wall with them.
I was like, well, yeah, I don't think I noticed that the first time I saw it, but I saw it now. I was like, wait, what is, wow. Wow.
Let's see. We've still got Andy being a horrible boyfriend cheating with Elizabeth Banks, as you do. There's a scene where they have like, you know, at a barbecue, she's got barbecue sauce smeared all on her face, and he's a little reluctant. He's like, you know, you got barbecue sauce all over your face. It's pretty foul. And she's like, I know. Come on, I want to make out. And then he makes out with her, and then he just breaks up with her by saying, "You taste like a burger. I don't like you anymore." Which very very special line to me because a gift I once got from my friend Frankie. This was something that was like I think a giveaway prize at the midnight screening of Wet Hot American Summer. They had a packet of McDonald's barbecue sauce, and it's signed by Elizabeth Banks.
Oh shit!
So he got me one of those packets, and he has it. He put it up in a nice frame with a still of Elizabeth Banks with the barbecue sauce all over her face in this movie. And he gave that to me in a nice frame because he knew like I had a bit of a crush on Elizabeth Banks from this movie.
I mean, who doesn't?
And I have that on the wall of my apartment still.
Okay. Yeah, nice. Wow.
Yeah, I'll take a picture of it so we can tweet it out from the SNL Nerds Twitter.
Oh, please do. Yeah, I think the people need to see that.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, in the movie Role Models, if you watch the blooper reel of that movie, because Paul Rudd and Elizabeth Banks play boyfriend and girlfriend in that, in the outtakes, at one point they're kissing, and he just says, "You taste like a burger," and she says, "I don't like you anymore," and then they depart, which is it's very cute. They're doing their own little callback.
Oh, nice. Look at that. That's fantastic. So another storyline which I kind of dug is we have like the Artie, who's the kid who does the morning announcements.
Yes,
like he has a through line. He's like constantly like on the loudspeaker, you know, giving the announcements and kind of like pretty much like a morning DJ. And then we have McKinley saying, "Hey Artie, you better go shower because like I don't want your parents yelling at me because you haven't showered once since you've been here all summer." And of course Artie's like, yeah, I'll do it. And then McKinley leaves, and of course he goes back to talking into a microphone,
which we realize that the camera pans down and then we see that the none of the equipment is hooked in, so he is talking to literally no one. It is not being broadcast at all.
So Artie's kind of I guess nuts, because he's just like, he's caked in dirt, just talking to no one. I mean, he's kind of like a podcaster, but,
Did you recognize who was the voice of Artie?
No, I did not.
So Artie is actually dubbed throughout the movie by Sam Levine from Freaks and Geeks.
Whoa, really?
Yeah. Apparently, David Wayne went to Sam Levine. I'm not sure if it's Levine or Levine.
I think it's Levine.
I apologize. Levine? Okay. So I apologize for mispronouncing it. But David Wayne went to Sam and he was like, you know what? I think I cast the wrong kid for this part and he doesn't have the right voice for the, I need a more of a DJ type voice. And so he had Sam Levine dub the whole part.
Wow. So Artie doesn't use his real voice at all in this?
I don't think so. No. I mean, you might hear his real voice when he's not on the air, but, but no, when he's broadcasting, quote unquote broadcasting, it is Sam Levine from Freaks and Geeks.
I was not aware of that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So.
All right. Interesting. I like that.
Yeah, I didn't learn that until like years after the film and like an oral history of the film, I think.
Okay. So. Wow. The more you know.
Dun, 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 dun.
All right. So that's one scene I really dug. Another scene I really dug is when later on in the day, Coop is talking to his campers and they have a big baseball game against the kids at Camp Tiger Claw. And of course, Coop goes, yeah, because like they're the snobby rich kids. And then Coop gives this rousing speech saying, look, I know those kids at Camp Tiger Claw, they're like the rich, snobby kids, and we're just like a bunch of poor ragtag motley crew. But like, I think if we can be pulled together and use our know-how and guts and just pull, and we can win the game if we use like this, you know, last minute play that we just kind of pulled out of nowhere at the last minute. It's like, so what do you say, kids? And then the campers are like, I don't know, this feels kind of trite. It feels like it's been done before.
Yeah, this seems really like really well-worn territory. And he's like, oh, is that how y'all feel? And they're like, yeah. And then, yeah, you see Michael Showalter just dash off to the school bus that just pulled up in the background. And like, you hear sort of muffled dialogue, and it's like, oh, yeah, no, I totally see where you're coming from. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. And he just comes running back. He's like, yeah, they were totally cool with it.
Yeah, so it's them, you know, poking fun at like an old trope that you see in, you know, Bad News Bears and Meatballs and whatnot, which I appreciated that.
Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, it's again, it's a neat, unexpected twist on a cliche scene, and I really enjoyed that. Meanwhile, through all of this, we have Coop and Katie gradually getting closer and closer because Andy is such a negligent boyfriend. They end up spending a good part of the day together, and they end up kissing, you know, but you know, then Katie tells Coop that kissing him was a mistake, but Coop confesses his love to her in this big speech.
I don't care if you're late for shul.
Yeah. I don't care that you're bilingual, and I don't care. And it's just like,
why would that be a problem?
But you know, it's very, very funny.
There's one cool line that I thought was funny where, because after they exchange sweaters and flannel, Coop is on the phone to his parents saying, oh, I met someone. And then you hear Coop saying, I don't know. I mean, she might be. I mean, she has a pretty big nose.
Yes. Yeah. And that's the only end of the conversation you hear.
You know what was said.
Yeah, you know what his parents just asked, and Showalter and Wayne are both Jewish, I guess I should say.
Right.
So they are allowed to make this
absolutely
joke.
Wait, Showalter is too? I thought it was just Wayne. Oh.
Well, I'm assuming Showalter.
You know? All right, L'chaim.
I mean, Showalter sounds like a Jewish name, does it not?
I guess I never thought about it. I guess so. All right. Shalom, okay. Showalter.
All right. I mean, you're going to make me look like the asshole now.
I don't know. I mean, you probably know more than I do. You probably is. So.
Well, now I got to Google it.
Oh, well, right. Fine.
All right. It doesn't slander his personal life in his on his Wikipedia page. So I don't know, but I'm going to assume he is because ER.
There you go.
So.
I don't know. What else happens? I mean, we get to know Gene a little bit more, who is in NAM, who constantly brings that up throughout the movie. And he's constantly saying odd things when he's trying to berate Gary. Like, oh, like, I'm going to go fondle some sweaters. And Gary's like, what'd you say?
Yeah.
It's like, no, I said, I'm going to flattle my whatever. I forget what he said.
Yeah.
But, like, he was always covering over the fact that he said something very telling about himself. Like, you know.
Yeah, yeah. He says, you know, oh, that's in the cabinet right next to my dick cream. I'm going to go hump the fridge. He's, yeah. It's, he says these weird things that hint at this odd inner life that he has.
Yes, very much so. And and then which comes to this big, I guess he has this realization moment, or I don't know, like he's an odd duck, because at one point while he's by himself and, you know, he said something weird, but he covered up for it. While he's in the kitchen, this can of vegetables begins talking to him.
Yeah, it's a can of vegetables that is voiced by H. John Benjamin, who gives him the insight that Gene needs into his life. Oh, and by the way, let me just insert something that I just discovered. Michael Showalter's father is Episcopalian and his mother is Jewish. So therefore, if your mother is Jewish, you are Jewish.
Stand corrected. I stand down, sir. I stand down. I yield.
Michael Showalter, Jew.
Jesus.
I didn't mean that to sound as accusatory as it came out.
That, wow. That's, oh boy. We here at the SNL Nerds, we love and appreciate all faiths. So,
yes.
Don't.
Yeah.
Oh boy. Okay.
So,
okay. Oh yeah. So the can of vegetables that start.
The can of vegetables. It gives Gene the confidence he has to declare, you know, that and be proud of who he is. And he proudly humps a fridge in front of all the camp to tremendous applause.
Yeah, like at one point, the can of vegetables says, "Like, look, I mentioned something about him being able to suck his own dick."
And, yeah. And he does it a lot.
Yeah, and I was like, "What is that?" Again, another part where I could not have predicted this, and I was just befuddled. Yeah. I was like, what is happening?
The movie is getting very bizarre by this point. But because Gene had his breakthrough, he's also able to help out Coop, because Katie, she has second thoughts after kissing Coop. She says, like, hey, kissing you is a mistake, and Coop confesses his love. And yeah, Coop just, you know, he's going on a crying jag. And Gene finds him in the woods, and he's just like, "Be proud of who you are." And we get
a montage.
Gene, yeah, we get another montage of Gene teaching Coop the new way, and it's like sort of a training montage to the song "Higher and Higher," and we just see you know, like Coop trying to snatch a pebble out of Gene's hand. We see them like running. You know, and it's like something out of one of the Rocky movies where Apollo Creed's training Rocky, and they hug on the beach to a freeze frame.
Yeah, there's one scene where like Coop is like kind of in a like an AA circle talking to people, like smoking a cigarette, yeah, drinking coffee,
and the can of vegetables is there too.
Of course, he's there. Of course, he's there for moral support.
Right, right. And you know, they're practicing dance moves, you know, so it's kind of something like out of Dirty Dancing too, you know, where you see him like he can't get the dance moves down and he's getting frustrated, but then by the end he's like mastered the dance moves. And
this movie's all over the place.
Yeah, yeah.
So then we also, again, another storyline, we go back to Henry and Beth, where Henry's been hanging out with the indoor kids, as it were, and he has to tell Beth about something he's discovered. And then there's this one cool scene where they walk past, like, they're walking on, you know, past the lake, you know, and they walk past a picnic table, and then Henry says, "I have something to tell you. Just meet me in 10 minutes by the picnic table."
10 seconds.
Yeah. Yeah, 10 seconds. So then he walks to the picnic table, and then Beth is just waiting there for 10 seconds. Then she walks to the picnic table, and then at that point, all the indoor kids are there with, like, telescopes and everything. And Henry's like,
"Yeah,
I'm so glad you could meet me."
Yeah, yeah. And Henry's wearing like a lab coat, and he announces what he's actually been working on all this time. He's discovered that like a rogue piece of Skylab has broken away and is about to fall.
Right. So they need to build like a tracking device in order to maybe pull the Skylab debris away from where it's going to land, which is the rec hall, which, you know, tonight's the big night of the talent show. And so that can't happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And so they make a homemade Skylab tracking device where it's like basically an upside down trash can with all sorts of odds and ends stacked on top of
it. Yeah, there's like a stack of donuts on there for some reason, and a can of Spam.
Yes, yes. And it's during this when Henry reads a particularly bad readout that he looks at the paper that's just been spit out, and he just goes, "Oh fuck, Michael," which one of my favorite lines in the movie, I must say.
Yeah, because that just came out of nowhere. It's like, "Oh fuck, Michael."
Oh fuck, Michael.
See, people, we brought it back. We brought it back.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is right up there with Coop saying to Katie, "I want you inside
of me." That was funny.
Which, you know, very romantic thing for a man to say to a woman.
Yeah, like, that's from the heart.
Yeah, that's from the heart. That's from the heart. And I've seen, at some of the live Stella shows, where Michael Ian Black and David Wayne and Michael Showalter have performed together. And they said, you know, "Hey, we're going to do a thing with the audience now. You know, just turn to the person next to you and say, 'I want you inside of me.'" You know, it's like a little get to know you thing.
Yeah, that is, wow, that is intimate.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh man, all right. So
it breaks the ice. Huh? It breaks the ice.
Yeah, I can see that. Just loosen it up. Hey, just tell the person next to you whether you know them or not. I want you to be inside of me.
But then we're about ready. Like all these plot threads converge, and we're at the big talent show, and we see the various campers perform. There's a group of kids who sing "Day by Day" from Godspell.
Yeah.
And they give a really impressive performance, and then everybody seems to be getting into it, and they're singing along and clapping, and then as soon as it's over, they're just booed horribly.
Yeah, because I think that was hilarious, because like, I think people, I got to look into my notes, but I think like people maybe got the impression, because the performance of Godspell ends with like a cross in the background that's lit up. And I think some people might have thought they were booing the performance because of the cross, and it's like a Jewish camp.
Oh, you know what? I never got that before, but that makes sense as a rationale.
I think it's like in the trivia on IMDb. I'll see if I can find it. But yeah, like...
Okay, interesting. Okay.
Oh, wait, here it is. Yeah. The filmmakers have stated that the reason the talent show production of Day by Day is booed is often misunderstood. The audience boos in spite of it being particularly well produced, but it's commonly assumed to be because it ends with the cross being lit up and the camp is mostly Jewish.
Okay. All right. I learned something.
Look, we're both learning, man. Life's about lessons.
We are. Yeah.
So we should probably get back to this storyline, the Victor and Neil storyline, which is actually one of my favorites at this point.
Yeah.
So we have Victor who ran all the way into the night back to camp, because like at this point it's like 8 o'clock at night and he's still running to camp. Right. Neil beat him to camp because he was riding a motorcycle he found that was just there. There was this one quick scene that I really like where like Neil pulls up to the camp and to the cabin where Beth is, and it's clearly not Neil. It's clearly his stunt double.
It's the world's most obvious stuntman, because he's not even built like Joe Latrullio, and he's wearing a horribly obvious wig. And then the camera like quickly pans over to Janine Garofalo.
Yeah, it's like
who's like, "Hey Neil, what's up?"
And then the camera goes back, and then it's Joe Latrullio.
yeah, and it's all the more obvious because of how they did it. They tried to do you see that sort of thing in movies all the time, but they usually try to disguise it, and here they're not trying to disguise it at all.
Right. So at this point, Neil says, "Hey, Victor abandoned the kids, and they're about to go over the falls." And then they cut to the kids you know, at night in a raft about to go over the falls, quote unquote, because like the way it looks like they're the kids are standing still in the water near the falls. It looks they're clearly not going to go over anywhere.
No, no, they're I'm sure that like in real life they were like secured with a rope or something like that, but they're all just sitting in their raft and they're all just screaming, but it's like
right, and so then Victor makes it back to camp. He sees Abby was making out with one of the campers. Like Abby's been making out with, I think she made out with two other counselors throughout this at this point. And he, you know, Abby,
she has a busy day. Abby gets around.
She puts that tongue wherever she likes.
And Victor, of course, is horrified when he gets back, and she just goes, "Hey, you snooze, you lose, dude."
Right. So then at this point, Neil and Beth go up to Victor saying, Victor, the kids are about to go over the falls. You're the only one that knows those rapids. And so they run back to the rapids, and you know, it doesn't take them that long to get there, apparently.
Yeah.
And so Victor goes to save the kids, but the camera is constantly on Neil, who's like kind of narrating what's happening. Like, we never see Victor save the kids at all. We just see Neil like, "Oh, be careful. Oh, he's got the kids. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the camera cuts to Victor and the kids safely, like, walking up the hill, which I thought was a hilarious thing, because, like, that's kind of clever.
Yeah. It's very cute scene. And, I've seen that sort of thing in like old cartoons. Like in it happens in Johnny Quest at one point where like Race Bannon, the big bodyguard guy, he's getting into some sort of fight, and whenever they get to a move that's too tough for the animators to animate, they just cut to Johnny Quest going like, "Oh my god, a karate chop!" Pretty funny.
So back to the talent show. I think we also forgot to mention this. Is the talent show is being hosted by an old Catskills comic, Alan Shemper, played by Michael Showalter.
Yeah, Michael Showalter, and he's playing. He's delivering all these hoary old jokes. you know, like, "I went to camp so long ago that Jesus Christ was my counselor." And everyone's just laughing at him. They cannot get enough of this guy.
He's bringing the heat.
He's killing it.
So
you know, you wish you had a hot set like
this. This dude can headline a Stress Factory whenever.
Yes.
So while that's happening, Henry and the indoor kids are trying to figure out how to prevent the Skylab from landing on the rec center. Then they realize the rec hall. So then they realize that like they need like a random bunch of numbers in order to maybe offset from where the Skylab is going to fall, and that's where we have our man from Millburn, New Jersey. He's a dungeon master, of course. He has a 20-sided die on him, and he's like rolling. They're rolling the die, trying to figure out how to push the Skylab away from the rec hall.
Yes.
And as you, and then at one point, I think Beth says, "Oh, well, let's all pray that this works." And then, of course, they all do like a Jewish prayer, like Baruch Atai. Then we have, and while that's happening, the talent show's going on. You know, kids showing their talent. One kid's like balancing a broom handle on his hand. Another kid is like, you know, "White folks be like this, but black brothers, they be like this."
Yeah. He's doing like a word for word stand up routine. And people are like, "That's true. That is so true."
Like, I hate white people so much.
Yeah.
And then also at this point, that's when we see Ron, Gail's ex-husband, played by Judah Friedlander, come up telling Gail he wants, you know, he wants her back. But all the kids are supporting her, saying, "You know, stand strong. Say, you know, you will not be treated like this." And then Gail sends Ron packing. So we get a nice little Judah Friedlander cameo.
Yeah, and apparently, and by this point, Gail is in a full-fledged relationship with the camper who is consoling her, Aaron. And apparently at the end of that scene, as the button to that scene, he was supposed to kiss her, but because the actor in real life was only 12, he was very uncomfortable about kissing a full-grown Molly Shannon. And so instead, he just sort of tenderly brushes her hair.
I think that works better. Like, Yeah.
It worked better, I mean, because you get the humor and you don't really get the ick factor.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you want to avoid... I mean, I'm all for pushing the envelope and edgy, but you don't want to be like, oh, is this pedophilia? This is getting a little too close to yikes.
Yeah, yeah. And then also during the talent show, we have Coop making his triumphant return. That's sort of the remade Coop, and he's learned the new way from Gene. And he comes back, and he's in a cut off belly shirt, and the early 80s short shorts. And he says, like, "Hey, I've done a lot of growing and learning since we last spoke just after lunch." And he comes in, and it's such a difference that even Andy, Paul Rudd, does a double take. And it is my favorite double take in the history of double takes.
It's a good double take.
It is spectacular. I mean, it's just, I am sure that this is a GIF floating around online. And it is one of my favorite Paul Rudd moments in a career filled with favorite Paul Rudd.
Yeah, because he's just like, wah, 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 wah?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he just does a glance, and then he goes back to what he's doing, and then he comes back and he's like, "Oh!" And
yeah,
it is not subtle, but it is all the more hilarious because it is not subtle.
Right. So then Coop gives Katie like this small box as a token of his affection. Then he
like a ring box,
right?
Know?
And then he walks off. And so then after this, then we have Steve, played by Sussman, who's like the nerdy kid at camp who like he hasn't made any friends. And he's like the last guy to perform. And this is where the movie gets really weird.
Yeah, no, this is the point where it gets
this
really
weird. This is it, okay. Yes. Okay. The other stuff was fine. This is like, what?
Yeah, yeah. And he starts summoning up mighty winds. He apparently, the project he's been working on all summer is he can control the weather.
Yeah, because, I mean, throughout the movie, he's kind of talking like a robotic voice. He's just very odd. He's playing with chickens. And, like, people don't know what to make of him because he talks like a robot, like he's from outer space or something. And so his big talent is he puts on sunglasses, he raises his hands, and, like, this big tornado, this big, apparently he's like Storm from the X-Men, like, this big wind he's able to control within the rec hall, and that wind is able to push the Skylab that was going to land on the rec hall to the side, so the debris falls like to an open field, and everybody's like left bewildered at all this, and then they give him a big standing ovation, and he's like the big hero of the day.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, because he can control the weather. I mean, that's gotta earn you some friends at summer.
Yeah, and again, like as I said before, like I couldn't. Like, another one of the things, like I said before, I kept on saying in this movie, like, I can never predict the next thing that was going to happen, and this I definitely could never predict it. I was like, what is this movie? What is happening here?
At this point, you're wondering if, like, somebody has slipped something into your dream.
I felt like a fever dream. I felt like, was I drugged?
Yeah, yeah. But
am I tripping?
You know, it's very absurd, and yeah, and it's kind of hilarious. You see Skylab crashing to the ground, this huge chunk of satellite just
yeah. Oh, and also during this point, Katie opens up the ring box and she pulls out Coop's flannel. She pulled out an entire flannel shirt from a small ring box, and then that's when she realizes that she loves Coop, so she goes, runs after him, and then she's like, "Oh, I love you, Coop." And then they make out.
Yeah, she confesses her love, and, you know, it's the heartwarming ending where the nerdy guy gets the girl. She realizes that her asshole boyfriend's no good for her, and she's just like, "I love you, Coop."
And, I love you, Gerald Cooperberg. You
know, thing, yeah, you know, Cooperberg Steen, yeah, and it's just, yeah, and.
And so the next day is the final day at camp. The kids leave, saying
they're all departing the camp, and we get like a little epilogue with everybody, and we kind of see who everybody is and all that.
Yeah, we see. So it's the next day. The parents are picking up the kids. We see Henry won a prize for his invention for deflecting the Hopkins Award.
He wins the Hopkins Award, which is this prestigious scientific award, and it's basically a giant bowling trophy.
Yes, very much so. And he runs up to Beth with it, saying, "Oh, I won the award, and I'm gonna be working in Cape Canaveral, in Florida." Then
yes, with NASA.
Yes, with NASA. And then Beth feels like, "Oh, are we breaking up?" And then there's one other funny part where Henry says, "Like, hold on," and he hands off the award to like no one. And
he just hands the award off camera to someone who obviously just took it, but it's just like there is literally no one next to him. Yeah. So then he's telling
Beth that he wants to be with her and he wants her to move down to Florida and like she can fly up to the camp to keep being camp director. And then Beth says that she's pregnant with his child.
Yeah, because they've been trying so hard over the last day.
Yeah, this all happens in a day.
Mm-hmm. And Gail, the art teacher, and Aaron, the camper, they're getting married, and everyone's really happy for them. They're invited to the wedding, and you know they're like, "Oh, we're going to have shrimp," and Beth says, "Well, just as long as it's not jumbo shrimp, because I'm allergic to oxymorons." And then, we have all these joyous romantic endings, and then we see Coop and Katie, and Coop's like, "Well, obviously, I think we should get together in the city this fall, and you know all that." And Katie gives a great speech to Coop, and I'm just going to quote it if that's okay.
Go for it.
Katie says, "Listen, Coop, last night was really great. You were incredibly romantic and heroic, no doubt about it, and that's great. But I thought about it, and my thing is this. Andy is really hot. And don't get me wrong, you're cute too, but Andy is like cut from marble. He's gorgeous. He has this beautiful face and this incredible body, and I genuinely don't care that he's kind of lame. I don't even care that he cheats on me. And I like you more than I like Andy Coop, but I'm 16. And maybe it'll be a different story when I'm ready to get married. But right now, I am entirely about sex. I just want to get laid. I just want to take him and grab him and fuck his brains out, you know? So that's where my priorities are right now. Sex. Specifically with Andy and not with you."
Look, that... I'm not sure who...
It's funny because it's true.
I'm not sure which guy wrote that, David or Michael, but that came from a real place. That came from... That came from like, the nice guy that got... You know, that wasn't able to get from.
Yeah, because that is how that story generally ends in real life. The teenage girl does not come to her senses and realize that her jerky boyfriend is a jerk. She's with a jerk because, you know, he's attractive and funny and charismatic and something. And yeah, and, you know, like you don't realize that the nerdy guy is cool until like your 20s or 30s.
Yeah, that cut close to me, too close to the bone.
Yes, yeah, and it's made all the funnier because like you see like the in the close up of Coop, you see the discomfort of him trying to just suffer through this gladly play out on Michael Showalter's face, and at one point he gives the quickest of glances to the camera, just breaking the fourth wall for seconds, like a second if that, and it's so funny.
Oh boy,
and it's just. Very funny ending, just because that's unexpected, and that's like pretty much the last note the movie leaves you on.
Yeah. Katie drives away with Andy, and you know, Beth sees how Coop's doing, and then they kind of both walk away, and then that's it. That's the movie.
That's it. And then we got the ending credits, and then a little bumper at the very end of the end credits of. That is a callback to something we saw early in the movie that I don't believe we mentioned before.
Oh, yeah, right.
All the counselors, they agree to meet up in 10 years to see what kind of people they've blossomed into. And there's some haggling about the time. They're like, "Well, should we get together at 9 or 9:30? Well, let's say 9 because that way we'll be here by 9:30. Well, why don't we say 9:30 and make it your beeswax to be here by 9:30? Because, I mean, we'll all be in our late 20s by then. I don't see any reason we can't be at places on time." So they decide 9:30. And McKinley's like, "Oh, good, because I have something at 11. You know, and I've already moved it twice and I can't change it." But we see all the counselors getting back together 10 years later in like 1991. And there he's like, oh, I'm sorry, I thought we said 9:30. And they said, no, we said 9, so we'd be here by 9:30.
Yeah, and that's it. It's like a quick little thing.
Yeah, and they're all watching the videotape that a camper made. We see, again, early on in the movie, we see a camper being sent home, and they say, oh, it's because he snuck into the office and he videotaped himself masturbating. And they are all the counselors are watching the tape of the camper masturbating.
Oh, I didn't even realize that. Oh, shit. I didn't even notice it because that scene was so...
Yeah. There's like a quick cut, and he's just like, go to town on himself. And I think you actually hear him say, it feels so good when the cum comes out.
Oh, God. I didn't notice that.
Yeah, so that's the last little heartwarming thing to leave you with.
It feels so good when the... I mean, worse to live by.
Yep. I mean, he's not wrong.
I gotta look for that. I totally missed that just because it was really quick, that last scene. So,
it's really quick, but yeah.
All right, and guys, that's Wet Hot American Summer. It is. What are your thoughts on it? What's your overall?
I mean, this is. I mean, I kind of said my general feeling of this movie. I really like the movie just because it's, partly because I just find it very funny, and partly just because it hit me so hard. It hit me at the right time in my life, and it reminds me of a lot of pleasant memories of a dear friend. And, and I just think it's a really creative movie, and it got so many great comedy careers started. It put Paul Rudd in a different direction in terms of his movie career. It gave us Elizabeth Banks. It gave us Bradley Cooper. It gave us, so many other cool people. And like the cast obviously has a huge affection for this movie too. They really bonded because it was like raining the majority of the shoot. They were like stuck inside for most nights. And so they really forced them to be together and bond. And they just sat around playing songs, drinking, and apparently hooking up together.
Oh, do tell.
Yes. Some of the cast members have talked about, there was some loving going on off camera.
Skyrockets in flight.
Let me see. Garofalo says, one of us would go, it was like high school. One of us would go on a booze run and it would be like, get me Jägermeister. And whatever they would bring back, you would get trashed. Adds 80 miles. A lot of people were in their 30s and late 20s, and yet we would sit around and get wasted like we were 16. Garofalo admits the combination of the close living conditions and alcohol resulted in a certain amount of bunk hopping, myself included. Yes, she says. That's what happens at camp, isn't it? I doubt that would happen now, especially since I'm sober, but I was younger and my inhibitions were soaked in whiskey. Yeah, I was a little bit free with my person.
Ooh la la.
And I remember distinctly when I read Amy Poehler's book, Yes, Please, which is like a semi-autobiographical book. She talked about how the behind the scenes of Wet Hot American Summer would make a nice steamy beach read. So,
dear diary. All right. I like it.
Yeah. I have no idea who might have hooked up with whom, but, I'm glad they all had a good time.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the summer. It's summer loving, having a blast.
Exactly.
I was going to say, like, this, it is interesting how this movie became like a cult classic, because like when this movie came out, it did not get good reviews. Like I was like looking at it, and I mean, on Rotten Tomatoes, it's at 38%, but then again, when an audience score, it's at 76. So it's like, it is one of those films that kind of found its audience later on.
Yeah, I mean, it became like a big cult movie. I remember Roger Ebert was just savage. He actually wrote a savage review about it using the Alan Sherman song, Hello Mudda, Hello Father. So he wrote his whole takedown of the movie in verse. One of the few times I've really, really disagreed with Roger Ebert about a movie, but just not his humor, I guess.
Yeah, he doesn't get it right some of the time. It happens.
Yeah.
Your heroes will let you down.
But it's so funny, but it's become such a cult. There've been a few spin-off projects from it. They released in 2015, they released some of the behind the scenes footage of the making of the movie. And they put it into a documentary called Hurricane of Fun, The Making of Wet Hot. So you see a lot of the hangout times making the movie. And that's entertaining. That's like a just an hour, pretty breezy.
Okay.
But they also did for Netflix, they got together and did a few spinoffs. They did The First Day at Camp in 2015.
Yeah. And I think we said before earlier that the joke was like, it's supposed to be the first day of camp, but they look way older than they do at the last day of camp. And the first day of camp, it's only 8 episodes, 30 minutes each. And it has a bunch of characters that weren't in the original movie. Kristen Wiig's in it, John Hamm, Michaela Watkins, Jason Schwartzman,
Josh Charles.
Weird Al Yankovic, John Slayer,
Chris Pine.
They got Chris Pine for this. I was like, whoa.
I think they were originally shooting that as a movie, but I think it eventually they through re-editing it, they turned it into an 8-episode series. In 2017, they did Wet Hot American Summer 10 years later, which was everybody coming back together. 10 years later.
Yeah, I got to see if they have. I haven't seen that one yet, but I imagine they put in that 9:30 gag in there as well.
Yeah, they. I mean, honestly, I didn't like either one as much as the first movie. They both have their moments, but I actually like my review of my original review of 10 years later just came up on my Facebook timeline just recently. I remember when First Day of Camp premiered. It actually premiered on Netflix on July 31st, which was the day before my birthday.
Okay.
So for my birthday that year, I got together with Frank and we marathoned the whole series.
Oh, nice.
Together and watched it. And there was one moment where it really, really cracked us both up. We laughed for like a solid minute after that, where we see the beginning of the Andy Katie romance with Paul Rudd and Marguerite Moreau. And at one point, he's trying to be suave, and he just comes up to Katie, and he's like, "Hey, Katie, remember when I farted on you and you fell in love with me?" And it was just so out of nowhere. Frankie and I lost it for about the next couple of minutes. We had to pause the show on Netflix because it was just so damn funny, just the way that.
Wow, guys!
The way that Paul Rudd delivered it, loved
guys.
It. Loved
if
it,
you're loved. If you're looking for a way to start your wedding vows. I mean, that seems like pure gold right there.
Yeah. We should also say that in the 10 years later, they did get everybody to come back for First Day of Camp. Some people were like a little limited in their availability because they were much bigger stars by that point. Like Bradley Cooper, he's like, "Oh, I'm going to be like the ski mask DJ guy." And he just like puts on a ski mask. And then in later scenes, you just see him. You see a guy in Bradley Cooper's costume with a ski mask. So obviously Bradley Cooper was not there for that scene. I think he was only free for a day or so. And for 10 years later, Bradley Cooper was busy directing and starring in A Star Is Born. So they just had him replaced by Adam Scott.
And of course, did they make mention of it, or they just kind of played it off like a...
Yeah, the gag there was Bradley Cooper's character of Ben had a nose job, and everyone was like, "Oh no, it's hardly noticeable," and everyone's just assuring Adam Scott through the entire thing that he doesn't look any different.
Far out. All right. So I mean, they're both, like you're saying, they're both okay, but they don't match up to the majesty that is the movie.
Yeah, I would say that's a fair assessment. You know, you do get some interesting backstory on some of the characters in First Day of Camp. A few characters who have unexpected backstories, but I'm not going to ruin it by spoiling the gags.
All right, so yeah, guys, check it out if you can. I'm gonna check that out now.
And it was also neat in First Day of Camp because they brought back the child actors who played campers in the first movie, but because they were all like older, like in their 20s by this point. They played adult characters, so they played new characters.
Oh, nice. I didn't even know that.
So that was a little, kind of cameo.
Okay. All right. I'll check it out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I know at least First Day of Camp is still on Netflix. I don't know if 10 years later is, or maybe reverse. They were both made for Netflix, but one of them has left Netflix for some reason, which I don't get how you produce something for Netflix and then it leaves Netflix. But
okay. I mean, last I checked, they were both on it, but I mean, I could be wrong.
Okay. Maybe they both still are. Maybe I'm mistaken. Yeah,
check it out.
The Hurricane of Fun is not on Netflix anymore, but I did find that on Vimeo this morning. Michael Showalter has put it up. Or excuse me, David Wayne has put it up. So you can watch that for free on Vimeo.
Ooh, sweet. Hurricane of Fun. All right, done. Watch it, guys. Check it out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay.
So big thumbs up for me.
All right. Yeah, and that's our episode, guys. You know, Wet Hot American Summer. It's really some kind of something. I mean, if you're watching it for the first time, it's not going to be what you expect, but it's going to be something you didn't know you needed.
Yes. Yes, that's a good way to put it.
All right. So, yeah, should we talk about, like, what the next movie we're going to talk about?
Yeah. Let me you know, just say that again. I did this episode because it's, you know, in tribute to my friend, Frank Vittorello. And if you'd like to make a donation in his name, a charity that was important to him was Snort, which was an animal rescue group on Facebook with on short-nosed dogs. So you can find them on Facebook. They're just do a search for Snort on Facebook. He had a beloved Boston Terrier, Hobart, who's just the cutest thing you ever saw. So if you want to make a donation in the name of Frank Vittorello, I'm sure that would be appreciated.
Okay. All right. Very nice, man. So. Absolutely. Yeah. Hobart, is that from Wash from Firefly?
I'm not following
you. Okay. No, they said the dog's name was Hobart. I thought that was because Wash's character from the TV show Firefly, his first name was Hobart, if I'm not mistaken.
I think it was a Firefly reference, but I don't know where Hobart came from. I'll ask his wife.
Okay. All right. Well, that was just me derailing the podcast. Sorry about that, everybody.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
No problem.
Yeah.
And
much appreciated.
Yeah, yeah. And the next podcast, the next episode we do that I will probably derail. We're gonna talk about the movie Caddyshack, guys.
Yeah, we decided, you know, we're closing in on episode 100. We want to up the ante. We want to keep the momentum going. So we're going to put a pin in how to beat the high cost of living for right now. We will circle back to that, but for next week we want to do Caddyshack.
Yeah, I mean, it's a classic film. You got the Dangerfields, you got the Murray, you got the Chase, you got Noonan, you got Ted Knight. I mean, my God.
Mm-hmm.
It's all things to all people.
Yeah. And so we're going to have fun with that. So check out the Caddyshack, and we'll come back to that, and, you know, we'll see how well that holds up.
Absolutely.
For today.
Absolutely. And as always, if you want to follow me on Twitter or Instagram, you can follow me at Darren Credible. That's D-A-R-I-N Credible.
And you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Trumbull Comic, T-R-U-M-B-U-L-L. In the word comic, and then you can follow the show's page at SNL Nerds Show.
As always, you can give us some money on our Patreon page at non-productive.com. You know, help us keep the lights on, help us keep this amazing content flowing and going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And if you want to tell your friend about the podcast, and if you want to give us a review on Apple or Stitcher or whatever your podcast app of choice is, please do that. That really helps us out. We want to spread the word about this show as much as possible.
Absolutely. And yeah, I guess that's it. I mean, is there anything else you want to say or anything else? You know, how should we end this thing?
You know, I just say, feel so good when the com comes out.
that's the best way. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, you know, what else is there to say? I think that's it. We'll see you next week. Love you, Frank.
R.I.P. Frankie.
So until next week, nerds out.
Nerds out.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Yeah, that was fun. That was fun.
Yeah, yeah. You came to play. You had tons of facts about it.
Well, I mean, I've picked up a lot about this movie over the years.
So. Okay.
There's probably some shit I forgot about too, you know. But
no, you brought it. You brought the heat, as the kids say.
Oh, good.
You did A-okay.
All right. Yeah, hope I didn't get too maudlin there, but
no, I mean, dude, the podcast is what it is. Sometimes it's not all upbeat and peppy. Sometimes it's a little bit more subdued. It makes it real, man.
Yeah. All right. Well, I really like your Caddyshack idea for next week. I think that's going to be good.
Oh, yeah. Thanks.
Get Kevin. We can reach out to him today or tomorrow, I guess, and see if he's up.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, I mean, it's just kind of like it just kind of came to me. I was like, oh yeah, we didn't. That's kind of like a big deal movie in the SNL pantheon.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm,
yeah, why not?
Why not, indeed? You know, especially since we've already kind of covered the behind the scenes of it with Futile and Stupid.
Yes, absolutely. I was thinking that too, because like, oh, we did go through the movies, those two movies Doug did, and so I was like, yeah, maybe we should just do this, and yeah.
All right. Well, I can't think of much else to say at the moment.
So. Yeah, no, I'm tapped out. I am no longer interesting.
I mean, you're barely interesting to start.
God. You son of a bitch.
But no, it's been fine. I mean, how was your week? I didn't even know.
Oh, it was okay. It was all right. Same old, just working from home. Kim did an online book club thing for her book.
Oh, cool.
Just plugging through. Day by day.
This has been a Non-Productive Media presentation. Executive producer, Frank Hablawi. This program and many others like it on the Non-Productive Network is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Please share it, but ask before trying to change it or sell it. For more information, visit non-productive.com.